This is the Simon Dell Show, where we take a deep dive into some of the week's most notable business and marketing stories and interview high-performing business leaders and marketing professionals to find out their lessons for success.
I think the futures, just with those two levers, going to be much, much more amazing for us than the present. The industry was participating well enough in the innovation ecosystem. It's a common model where it's sort of a lobotomy approach where they do everything for you.
Welcome to the Simon Dell Show. And this week we have a gentleman by the name of Peter Brad on the show. That's Brad with two D's, P-R-A-D-D. Peter was recently recognized as one of the top 10 most influential people in Australian technology. So really excited to have him on the show today. He has founded all sorts of companies. And if you're vaguely connected to the startup scene in Australia, you will recognize some of these names. He started at age 22, creating something called Qantas Postcards in partnership with Qantas, which was a service that let customers turn their own photos into real postcards, within 24 hours. He was a founding director and the very first CEO of Fishburners, which everybody should know is Australia's first and most popular tech co-working space. He's the founding director and initial CEO of Startup Australia, or Startup Oz. And that's an advocacy group for technology entrepreneurs, where he worked with Malcolm Turnbull on the National Science and Innovation Policy. And he's also currently the federal government's first thinker in residence for the Digital Transformation Agency. So interesting that he is resident. He's a resident thinker, which sounds like a very cushy job. But when you hear from him, you'll see that he has a lot of insight, a lot of experience that everybody can learn from. He's also running a company called the Beanstalk Factory, where he does, in fact, work with somebody called Jack, which was the most important thing. He's one of twins, so he has a twin brother, and he also has twin daughters, which, of course, happens with these things with twins all over the place. So he is on the show today, so listen in, enjoy that. Give us some feedback. If you can give us some feedback, let us know what you think, please do. If you want to do that on iTunes, give us rating and review, that'd be fantastic. Otherwise, if you just want to get hold of us or me and my business partner Matt, or just send me a message, whatever you want to do, however you're feeling. I'm on LinkedIn, I'm on Twitter, I'm on Facebook, I'm on Instagram. You can email us at hello@simondell.com. You can, find out more about us on the website, simondell.com. Whatever you want to do, it's we're there in the internet. So please come and talk to us, because we love to hear from you. We love to hear what you've got to say. But without further ado, let us jump in to the chat with Peter Brad. So welcome to the show, Peter Brad. Thank you very much for joining me today.
Awesome. And thanks for having me, Simon.
So I'm going to go straight into it, because when I kind of do the research about who I'm talking to and all those kind of things, I was having a look at your university career, and I got to say, it seems a strange mix of the things that you started your life doing, in terms of agricultural economics, finance, and corporate law. That seems a bit of a strange mix.
In terms of those two subjects going together?
Yeah.
So I went to university at the Sydney University, and I did an applied economics degree. I'm a twin. My brother's name's Matt, and we did the same degree.
Right.
I was always interested in economics and business, really. And so we decided to do an applied economics degree to agriculture, which is essentially running small and big businesses. It's domestic, it's international, it's finance, it's a whole lot of cool stuff. The corporate law side, I think, came from my dad, who works in the law industry, and I just took a subject in it. And it actually really helped me when I created Fishburners. I wrote the constitution for the not-for-profit, and so it's and many of my other businesses, that sort of corporate law side helped me. I think it's sort of when you enroll in degrees and you kind of get a list of stuff to pick, I thought that might be cool. And so I ticked the box and did a semester in corporate law.
There's not many people that think corporate law is cool, but, you know. I did 3 years of a law degree and got out and thought, I'm never, ever doing that again.
Yes. So I only spent 6 months doing it and I didn't carry on.
What sort of geared you towards the agricultural side of things? Did you have a background or experience or family in that area at all?
No, my dad lived in the country when he was younger, and I used to go there every, I suppose, Christmas to see my grandparents, and that was a country town called Young, which was famous for Australia's cherry capital, and so we'd always go to the cherry farms and things like that. That's probably the only tie I've got to agriculture. It is just the only applied economics degree, so if you don't want to do, that I knew of, if you don't want to do just a plain commerce degree, then that's sort of, you know, what the option was.
Right. Prior to that, the question I tend to ask everybody on the show is about their first job. What was the first thing that you did in terms of a job that somebody paid you for?
Yeah, well, as an entrepreneur, my brother and I used to go around and wash cars and mow lawns. Probably my first job. In terms of working as an employee, I worked at the local, sort of milk market or 7-Eleven store. Yeah. Not for long, the guy fired me. Didn't think I was very good, and I ended up getting a job I did two things. I did a stint in a seafood store called Costi Seafood over Christmas, and worked 36-hour stint at the age of about 14, and then I got a job at Video Easy.
There's all sorts of laws being broken there.
They didn't pay me much. The minimum wage was about, for that age, was about $5. So my parents were a bit gobsmacked when they saw that the paycheck that I brought home. But I was impressed, and I went out and bought myself a TV. From those two things, I learned a lot, though. So I learned the owner of Costi Seafood and the owner of the video store that I worked in would just come in. They drove Porsches. They would come in, take the money out of the till, and walk out. And I was doing all the work, you know, and not the glamorous jobs at that age. So that sort of planted the seed for me in terms of my business career. You need to own a business, not work for one.
What was there anything else that when you and brother were out sort of building your own business in terms of, you know, mowing lawns and things like that? What kind of made you want to do that yourself? You know, rather than go and get a paid job.
I think we're just too young to get a paid job at that stage. I think we were probably like 11 or 12.
Right.
So pretty young, just wanting to make a buck on the side and, I don't know, do whatever you did when you're 11 or 12. I don't even know what we spent it on. But we would get paid, you know, $30 a car, and you could do a couple of cars on a weekend, and you might get, you know, $50, $60, which at the time was pretty good. It was a lot more money than I had.
So when you came out of university, what was the, you know, after you've done the you know, the corporate law and the agricultural economics and all those kind, what were you thinking at that point as you came out? Was it that just find a job or build a company or, you know?
My thought was, which somebody had given me a tip for, was to if I don't go traveling right now, I'm probably never going to get the opportunity to go traveling. So my twin brother and I took a year off with one of our best mates, and we traveled the world. My brother and I went for a year. And just backpacked, you know, pretty cheaply, and basically took some credit cards out and racked up a bit of credit card debt. And we were comfortable doing that, knowing that we'd come back and get into a corporate career. My twin brother, when we came back, got a job pretty quickly in agricultural economics in a commodity trading firm. And I started my entrepreneurial business, my first business, which was a partnership with Qantas, and that was an idea I came up with when I was traveling around the world.
Yeah, I saw that. It was called Scribble Picks was the company.
Yeah.
What do you want to just give us a quick overview as to exactly what that did and what that entailed?
Yeah, so I was traveling with my brother. The first country we went to was Peru. It's back in 2006, so 12 years ago, and we did the Inca Trail when I saw Machu Picchu, came back to Cuzco, which is this beautiful little town that everyone starts at. And we went to buy a postcard to, you know, send a postcard home to our loved ones. And all the postcards were pretty terrible. And there just happened to be a Kodak printing machine next door where you could put your old card in from your kind of point and click camera, and a physical photo would be printed out at the bottom. And so we wrote on the back of that, and that's sort of the genesis for that idea. When I came back to Australia, I got in touch with a number of printing companies. One of them was Fuji Xerox, who introduced me to Australia Post, and they said they could print and post those postcards for 8 cents a unit, and at the time 50 cents for postage. So I thought 58 cents for the production, the manufacturing of these postcards, I can probably sell them for $3 or $4. I'm onto a winner here. And the guy from Fuji Xerox said to me, how are you going to get customers? Because you can't buy a customer for $2 or $3. And so I had a bit of a B2B sales background from a couple of jobs that I did when I was in university. And I just said, I'll call Qantas and, we'll pitch it to them. So I cold called Qantas's head office. Said I had an idea. I wanted to get in touch with their marketing team. They gave me the marketing@Qantas.com email or whatever it is. I sent an email to them saying, this is the offer. I want to create Qantas postcards for you. And one day I was driving home and I got a call from a company called Couple Point Marketing, and who was had been set up to sort of take these inquiries for Qantas. And they said, we really love your idea. We want you to come in and pitch to Qantas. So about a month later, I went into Qantas to the head office over in near Sydney Airport and pitched to about 16 people in the room, took them through the idea, what I wanted to do. And they loved it and said yes, sort of on the spot. And so there was Qantas Postcards was born.
That seems the sequence of events that you've said there. I mean, bear in mind, how old were you then? Probably 23, that sort of age?
I was 23, yeah.
23, yeah. That seems the way you've described it sounds very easy. You went, you found someone in Xerox. They introduced you to someone on Australia Post. You cold called Qantas. They actually responded. Was it that easy, was there sort of harder steps within that, or was it just that fortuitous that these things happened?
That was easy. It was fortuitous, I suppose, that things happened. And in terms of the business, there was lots of things that I found very difficult. For example, finding a partner to build the service for me, the technology. And I was very lucky again in meeting a guy called Greg Johnson, who was an incredible entrepreneur and, one of my, even today, one of my best mentors, who decided to help me out with it. That was probably the hardest thing for me in getting that business up and running. He brought an incredible amount of experience in dealing with a company like Qantas. And if you think about me as, where I was in my life, I was a uni grad. I'd never worked for any major companies before. I'd never run a tech startup before. I'd never run, my own business beyond some very small kind of hobby-based businesses. And there I was running Qantas Postcards for, one of the largest companies in the world and, a very iconic company.
Do you remember what you said on? Do you remember what you said on the phone to actually get a response out of Qantas? Was it simple as just I've got an idea and I want to talk to someone, or was there a way that you phrased it? You mentioned you've got a bit of a sales background, but I mean, cold calling's hard at the best of times, and people get rejected a lot. So is there a way that you would suggest people phrase these things or pitch these things?
Yeah, absolutely. I haven't codified it, or as one of my business partners, Jack DeLosa, talks about, sort of bottled the magic. I have done a lot of cold calling in my life. I worked for it was for Westpac at the time, selling life insurance over the phone, and got a lot of rejection. So have a lot of experience in being able to navigate a call and do that objection handling. I don't think the process was too difficult. It was really be nice to the receptionist, explain, what you want to do, get the general email, at the time, the offer was quite compelling, and I didn't get a lot of I didn't find that very difficult, or that there was much to it. And I think today it's much easier than it used to be, because everybody's now on LinkedIn and Twitter, and you can find out exactly, you know, who they are, what they like, and you can send communications that are quite personal to them. One tip in sales is, it does take, you know, don't be put off if your first response is no response. I was lucky in that sense, but often you have to follow up to 13 or 14 times is the stat. And so, you know, just sort of being tenacious and persistent is very important.
What was the, obviously you when you launched, you had a ready-made, you know, customer stroke partner with Qantas there. What other marketing did you do to get the brand out there and let people know about it?
Not much. Qantas was responsible for the promotion of the product. It was a Qantas branded product, so they promoted it through their own channels, their emails, their website, the in-flight magazine. We did some promotions at the lounge, that sort of stuff. When the iPhone came out in 2008, Qantas was quite slow to release their own iPhone app, so they didn't release their iPhone app until about 2012 from memory, and people stopped using point-and-click cameras. My customers wanted to use a mobile phone, and they wanted to take their photos from that phone and put them onto postcards. And without an app, I wasn't able to do it. So I did the same thing. I cold emailed at the time Expedia and TripAdvisor, who were had the biggest travel apps on the App Store, and went through the same process. And once I had Qantas behind me, it was much easier. I was a bona fide entrepreneur, I suppose, and had worked with a big brand. So once you have that endorsement from a big company, it definitely made those future partnerships, of which I had over a dozen, really easy to at least get in the front door.
You eventually you shut that business down, didn't you, when you saw that the market was changing?
Yeah, we shut it down in 2015. It was probably automated probably from around 2011. I tried a number of things to make it work, but the technology just kept moving so quickly. One of the things I didn't have was a mobile developer early on enough. And this is the time when, you know, apps like, you know, Instagram and the like were being created, and I probably missed out on some of the opportunities. Not saying that, you know, we would have been the next Instagram, but I definitely missed out on some opportunities around some really cool technologies. I never made my own brand, so I only ever had channel partners, and that's probably a regret. I probably should have tried to do something myself, just to give us a bit more freedom and flexibility over it.
Do you remember the point when you realized that was the end of the road for that?
By that stage I had, you know, I'd created Fishburners, and I was one of the founding directors of Fishburners and the initial CEO. Yeah. I'd done Startup Oz. I was almost into this, you know, the sixth company, the Beanstalk Factory. So I'd run a number of other companies before I shut that one down. And I was able to do that because the majority of the business was automated. Somebody else was doing the marketing. The technology would print the postcards, and so I was a bit fortunate, and just got to a point where the revenues dipped, and people stopped sending postcards. Yeah, and so instead of trying to change that business model, I was already, you know, my attention was already elsewhere. So it wasn't, I didn't have that kind of experience.
Okay, so Startup Oz, where did that idea come from? Was that sort of a collaborative idea with other people, or was that again something that just came to you?
No, it was it started out of an event that the startup ecosystem held, the Australian startup ecosystem held in Sydney back in probably 2012. We ran an event at PwC The Difference to really try and We went through a process called Scan Focus Act, which is an MG Taylor kind of facilitation technique run by PricewaterhouseCoopers. Google Australia had just commissioned PwC to do a big report on the impact to the Australian economy that startups could have in Australia. And it came out with some pretty big headlines in terms of being able to add over $100 billion to the economy and over 500,000 jobs to the economy by it was a sort of a 10-year time frame. And so 50 people from the startup ecosystem came together. I was invited onto the working group by Google Australia because of my role at Fishburners in being the managing director there at the time. After that event, one of the action items was to create a group that could provide a bit more of a coordinated approach to government, because government didn't have anybody that they could kind of talk with, and that's the way that the government likes to interface with industry, is sort of through an association. So we launched Startup Oz. I was the founding director with Alan Noble, who ran Google's R&D, and Bill Barty, who's a venture capitalist and currently runs Cyrus Venture Capital Fund. But we quickly expanded the board to include, you know, very prominent entrepreneurs from around Australia, people like, you know, Steve Baxter and Jana Matthews and Glenn Smith to join the board. And now the board of that organisation is actually quite large. I think it's about 10 people of really prominent people from around Australia.
When you think about the Australian startup space, obviously we're a smaller country in terms of population, not necessarily actual space. How do you feel it is? Do you think it's we have a healthy ecosystem here in terms of the startups, or are we lagging behind the US and the UK and other countries?
Yeah, well, there's startup ecosystem measures around the world, and they kind of do it on city. Sydney's, I believe, still in the top 20. I'm not 100% sure with the latest statistics. Australia has, just like the rest of the world, we've all significantly changed in the last 7 years. So when we created Fishburners in 2011, there was no technology co-working spaces for entrepreneurs. There was no organization like Startup Oz. The venture capital funding was very low and limited. And over those 7 years, we've gone from a very small amount of venture capital funding being available to startups to a huge amount, sort of over $1 billion being available. So there's been some changes in that. One of the reasons I personally wanted to start Startup Oz was as an entrepreneur with global ambitions, you're competing on a global playing field, and you're playing against competitors that have different rules. When we started Startup Oz, entrepreneurs weren't allowed to issue their staff options without paying tax, and sort of like paying tax on a lottery ticket. And so now we've changed those rules with Malcolm Turnbull in 2015 in creating the National Science and Innovation Agenda. We've changed the rules so that now it's more of an equal playing field. And we're having some really amazing startups come out of Australia that are, you know, globally recognised as world leaders. Companies, obviously, you know, you hear companies like Atlassian and Canva and others that are doing, you know, they are the unicorns. They're in the unicorn club, and they're happening right out of Australia.
A lot of people would know Atlassian and Canva and those kind of people. Are there any others that you see that are you know, for want of a horrible expression, sort of bubbling under, that you think will become, that will achieve that kind of status within the next few years?
There are heaps, and Startup Oz is launching our Crossroads report on the 5th of December. So in about a month, it'll be available on the website, startupoz.org. And we map out the startup ecosystem. So we keep an up-to-date list of all of the big tech startups. So I won't spoil the surprise, but in there is a list of all the companies to watch. And it's probably something I'm even compounding. We often go to those well-known examples of Atlassian and Canva, but there are some really other big, amazing startups that are out there that we need to increase the visibility of them, so that people understand that it's a viable career.
There's a lot of talk and a lot of things that you read these days certainly coming out of Silicon Valley and, you know, the rest of the US, about innovation slowing down and a lot of the ideas that, you know, maybe would have been created, you know, 7, 8, 10 years ago by, you know, two guys in a bedroom, that we don't have the capacity to create those kind of small scale things that can scale very rapidly, that two guys in a bedroom or two people in a bedroom, not being sexist, is those days are gone. Do you believe that, or do you think there's still the opportunity for a small group to affect a massive change?
I think, I understand that viewpoint, and I don't agree with it. I think there's a huge amount of opportunity, if not more opportunity than there was, looking back over the past 20 years and looking forward over the next 20 years. You've got platforms like, in-home assistants like Amazon Echo or Alexa with Amazon Echo or Google Home that are allowing you to create skills. The Internet of Things is allowing you to do a huge amount of things with data. You've got wearable technology that you can interface with. There's so many of these emerging technologies like virtual reality and augmented reality and robotics and artificial intelligence. And there's if you look at the Gartner hype curve, you know, 5 to 10 truly world-changing technologies coming at us in the next 5 years, 5 to 10 years, and they're providing entrepreneurs and large businesses with incredible opportunity, just like the iPhone did, and, you know, moving to a mobile platform, and just like, 20 years ago with the internet exploding, those sort of opportunities are about to come to us right now.
If you had to pick one emerging technology to put all of your money into, what would your, you know, what would your preference be?
I think in the short term, I would be really looking at the Amazon Alexa platform. I think that's got incredible power. If you look at the way that companies like Google and Facebook make money from visual display advertising, when people move to voice and using in-home assistants like Amazon Echo, all of that market changes. It's an entirely new market. And, you know, consider this. You're thinking of buying something from Amazon because Amazon just make it so easy that you don't want to go anywhere else. You say to Amazon Alexa, you know, I need some more finished dishwashing tablets. And Amazon Alexa says, well, actually, considering your preferences, you probably want to use this more environmentally friendly brand. It gets great reviews. Do you want to try it out? I'll give you a 20% discount. And you say, sure, I'll do it. Let's give it a go. And all of a sudden, boom, she said that, you know, they've shifted you from Finnish over to something else. And I think that's going to be incredibly powerful. If I was to think of another technology, it's or an industry, it's specifically around health. I think the health industry has a lot of advantages to be gained from a number of those emerging technologies. And the big giant companies like Google and others are putting a lot of money into the health space. And as a consumer or, you know, a human, that data that's enabling us to make more informed decision and not be sort of manipulated through marketing and brand and making more data-informed choices and the ability to have better health outcomes, I think the future's just with those two levers going to be much, much more amazing for us than the present.
I want to get around to talking about fish burners because obviously I think it's a brand that's become widely recognized within the startup industry across Australia. But I first want to talk about your current project, the Beanstalk Factory, and I'm hoping you've got someone called Jack working for you, because his email address would be cool as. But to talk to me about when you go and read the blurb on your website, I'm interested to understand why companies call you guys in. And I don't mean that in disparaging your lack of experience and ideas, obviously. But why do a lot of these big companies why are they not able to tackle innovation themselves? Why do they need external people to do it for them?
So there's probably a couple of questions there. Firstly, my business partner was called Jack DeLosa. So yeah, he did her.
So is that where the beanstalk came from?
The Beanstalk name came from my wife, and it was just around the story of Jack and the Beanstalk, and, you know, they had an unproductive cow and, you know, stopped producing milk, and so he went and had to sell. It was the, you know, sell your business, sell your asset. And instead of doing that, he traded it for some magic beans and became wealthy. And so the story behind the Beanstalk factory is if you're with industry and large organizations, your assets becoming less, you know, less productive and maybe even running out of the ability to create that revenue for you or that, that milk. What do you do? And so our whole value proposition was around creating a, which is the reason we have factory in the name, giving you a tried and tested methodology and approach to being able to create that value. And so that's sort of where the name came from. I also learned a thing. Yeah. If you look at the names of my businesses, Scribble Picks, I don't, you know, if we ask some of the listeners today, we'll probably get five or six different versions of the spelling. Fish Burners, what's it about? Is it burning fish? How do you spell it? Yeah. Startup Oz, AUSOZ. So I learned a lot around naming businesses. The Beanstalk Factory being one of those, you know, well-known fables, but also very easy to spell was, you know, a tip there. In terms of I created the business after doing Startup Oz and Fish Burners because I didn't think industry was participating well enough in the innovation ecosystem. I sort of, the government had spent lots of money and changed policy. All these support infrastructure was coming up, places like Fish Burners and Blue Chili and, you know, Inspire 9 and York Butter Factory, all these incubators and accelerators. Venture capital money was coming in, but corporate Australia wasn't playing. And Australia had the lowest industry research collaboration in results in the OECD. And I thought somebody needs to do something about this because as an entrepreneur, corporates are two things to you. They're either customers, like they were for me with Qantas, or they acquire you, which would have been nice if Qantas had done. and in Australia, if we're not acquiring, when you run a business, you've got four options. You either shut it down, you run it as a hobby business, you do an IPO, or you do a trade sale. And around the world, the majority of exits for entrepreneurs are for trade sales. And in Australia, we just don't see them. And the reason we don't see them is because there's a number of reasons, but one of them is just large organizations don't have the knowledge dispersed throughout and to sort of have that maturity. So the Beanstalk Factory is all around helping you create innovation environments to get innovation done and moving you up the maturity curve. Why can't they do it themselves? What we're doing is enabling people that can do it themselves to do it better. We're bringing, I suppose, more firepower to the inertia of some of these large organizations. We've got extra, you know, unique things about us, including our networks and just the sheer depth of experience that our team has. And our approach is around capability uplift, where if you compare us to some of the other, you know, tier one consultancy firms, it's a common model where it's sort of a lobotomy approach where they do everything for you, but they won't do any IP transfer. So you're left without the skills yourself. And so our approach is very different. And so that's why organizations and hire us is we come in, we're genuine, we've got great, you know, I've got a great brand, I've done, you know, a lot of successful stuff. We know what we're talking about and we get in and show results early and get it done.
I think you used there was a really important word that you used in that segment there was the word inertia. Mm-hmm. You obviously see that a lot. But what are some of the things or what are some of the reasons these big companies have that inertia and what are some of the ways that you sort of help them tackle it?
I think, there's a number of reasons that large organizations have inertia. One of the main ones is it's very difficult to run an ambidextrous organization or an organization that focuses on really, really profitable business models today that are churning out billions of dollars of cash and knowing that you've got a life limit on that business model and at some point you're going to need a new replacement business model to focus on that. Doing both is incredibly difficult. And if you look at the case study of GE with their CEO recently, he focused really on Predex and he focused on building the future business and didn't focus enough on business today. And so he ended up having the corporate raiders come in and they closed down the entire innovation function and just focused on today. Because today, short term will yield you that cash. So that's part of it. The The other part of it is there's just a huge amount of change that needs to happen in these organizations. And without a, we call it the short-term, the long-term approach, what we often see is people doing short-term activities, things like hackathons or opening up an innovation lab and expecting long-term results. And so what we need to do is create an innovation thesis, really understand where the value is for the organization, understand what culture is that's required to get there, and be very clear on both of those things, and then invest in people's capability. We're doing things we've never done before. We don't know how to do. There's really low training and development budgets in Australia for these large organizations. And the best value is training your existing staff rather than just trying to replace them because they have all this latent knowledge about how you work, who your customers are, the intricacies of the process, and training them is actually not that difficult. If you hire people that don't know your organization, it just falls flat on its face in terms of, en masse, if that was the sort of strategy. So it's a longer shift, it's a long game, using some of those short-term levers to get you there, and that helps you overcome some of this inertia. But it is a battle, it is a long-term fight. You need somebody that's got persistence and resilience and passion for the change, and you need support from the top. And if you don't have support from the top, go somewhere where the the CEO wants to get it done.
If you're a smaller business, if you're down at the other end of the scale, and they obviously would struggle to call in or be able to sort of afford to bring in an organization like yourself, what are some of the things that perhaps a small business could do to start thinking about developing new ideas and innovation, within a small team?
Yeah, so this is a small organization that wants to innovate. What can they do? I think there's a number of things you can do as a limited, like a resource limited organization. Often small organizations are. I think finding ways to either partner with other organizations. So where can you lend your capabilities to another organization to assist them? Partner with other startups or other small businesses to create new value. Running things like a contest, for example. I had a lady that ran a jewelry company. She was a jewelry designer. And she had, she reached capacity. There was only so much she could do. And so I encouraged her to run a contest, identify other jewelry designers that were young that could come on, and set up a sub-brand where she would provide all the experience around creating the jewelry, the manufacturing, the brand, the marketing. But it was a different brand that would enable, her to mitigate the risk through that other brand, right, but still enable and mentor people. And she did that very successfully. So that's some ways. In terms of small organizations, you can participate in other people's innovation events. So if you've got clients in your industry, the big companies usually have things like hackathons and the like. So just reach out to them and let them know that you'd be interested in participating. That gives your staff some exposure to what your clients are after. If that opportunity doesn't present itself, I really encourage any small business to get into one of the innovation hubs, no matter where you are in Australia or around the globe. There is a place like Fishburners in your capital city. There are tons of them, and they're not just in capital cities. They're in rural Australia as well. And so get in there and meet other entrepreneurs and start to go to things like pitch events on a Friday night where you meet other people. And just there was a term coined by one of the entrepreneurs here: increase your surface area of luck. If you want to be lucky, you've got to be where it can find you. And sitting at home or being in your own office just with your team is not going to make you lucky. So get out there and be where luck can find you.
Well, just talk about Fishburners quickly, because obviously it's one of the major projects for yourself over the years. What was the toughest lesson you learned there with Fishburners? What was the biggest challenge you faced through the time with Fishburners? You're still with Fishburners, but
I work out of Fishburners, but I, Mike Casey and I, who were two of the five remaining founding directors, we retired at the 5-year mark. And Fishburners is about 7 years, and I'm really proud of Pandora Shelley, who's the current CEO. She started as a university student from UTS as our office manager and our first employee. I volunteered as the executive director to begin with, and And so she's gone from office manager as a student to CEO of, you know, a multi-million dollar charity that's a, you know, real pioneer in Australia. In terms of, probably one of the biggest lessons for me was in hiring staff. With a really high growth organization, you can hire staff for, you know, the next 6 months. But if you're growing very rapidly, you need to make sure that you're almost hiring staff for that 6 month mark in the future for the next, you know, 18 months. And you support them for the next 6 months, but then they can take over and really start to assist you get that growth. If you hire somebody that's right for today, your business is going to be limited by their abilities. And it means you've got to have conversations about, you know, moving them out of the business. And I've learned that lesson in many organizations. It's probably one of the biggest key takeaways for me is that if you look at US startups, and we helped Airbnb Australia launch into the Australian market, and at the time Uber was coming to the Australian market, the ruthlessness of those organizations in terms of making sure they have the right people for their particular stage of growth is just astronomical. And that's probably one of my key takeaways is hiring people, because if you hire the wrong person, it costs you an arm and a leg, as you and I will know. And if you hire the right person, they can just make you so happy and remove so much stress. And so, this is really personal. The wrong person kind of really makes your life tough, and the right person does the opposite. And so that sort of tip is hire somebody. If you are a high growth business, hire somebody for you'll have to support for the next 6 months where it really is out of their comfort zone, but they have a lot of skill in that next phase. And with Alex McCauley at Startup Oz, we did that really, really well. He was amazing. And so the board got in and supported him for that initial period. And, he learned to fly, and he's taken out that organization places that you know, I couldn't do.
Right. So I'm just going to wind up now. We've got a few more questions before we finish. Who do you learn from? Who's your inspiration? Who's the people that teach you every day?
I learn from, I still work at a fish burner, so I'm learning from all the entrepreneurs that are around me. I learn from my clients. I learn from, I'm very fortunate to be working with, you know, very senior executives day in, day out from a multitude of industries. And I work across government, university, you know, different industries in large and small organizations. But I also work with the doers, the people that do the work, and they teach me an incredible amount as well. My wife is an emergency nurse, and she brings a lot of experience from that world, which I had no exposure to as well. I do read a lot, and watch YouTube videos and listen to podcasts, and I follow a lot of the Facebook groups for startups and, you know, product management, and a whole lot of different Facebook groups as well. So I'm constantly sort of consuming stuff. I love reading Harvard Business Review as a source as well. And I suppose I'm just lucky and fortunate to have a really amazing network of awesome thinkers that I have very, you know, robust conversations with. One of my staff members, Leo Serta, who's just finished up with us in a full-time role, but he's doing some contracting, taught me a huge amount. He was, out of AMP and ANZ and worked with me for about a year and a half. He taught me a lot. Jack DeLosa, who was my business partner and, you know, founder of the Entourage, incredible wisdom. And these people that you surround yourself by, they're, you know, I'm learning, but they're learning just as much and fast as I am. And so there's just so much growth in those sort of those communities of people that are willing to learn. That's sort of where I look to.
You mentioned the Harvard Business Review there and the Facebook groups that you're in. Are there any books that you've read sort of within the last, 3 to 5 years that you would recommend people go out there and buy?
I love a number of books. One is that I recommend to people is Stephen Covey's Seven Habits of Highly Effective People. Seven Habits of Highly Effective People. I found that book to be incredible. David Allen's Getting Things Done in Terms of Productivity was great. There's a book by a guy called Simon Reynolds called Why People Fail. That has a huge amount of tips just on absolute focus on what you want and going out there and, you know, getting the life that you want. From a lean startup perspective, I'm a huge fan of Ash Moria's work running lean, and he's got another book called Scaling Lean as well, and so around the lean startup approach. I really love a book at the moment that was written by a lady that used to be the president of Change.org and currently runs Facebook's groups and communities. She wrote a book called Purposeful, Are You a Movement Maker or a Manager? And she's just got so many incredible stories that sort of inspire you. I think that's another really, really awesome book as well.
What about some brands that you like? And they don't have to be startups that you've worked with, but what are some of the sort of brands that you look at that constantly, you constantly enjoy what they're doing or like what they're doing?
I mean, I'm an Apple fanboy, I suppose. I like their technology. In Australia, there's a in Sydney, Barangaroo is a new kind of precinct that came online, and the two of the three towers is run by a guy called Liam Timms, who runs International Towers. And Liam is by far, out of the thousands, you know, tens of thousands of people that I've met, that one of the most principled business people. And I've just thoroughly enjoyed watching him create a community in International Towers, which is probably about 90 to 100 floors of A-grade resident, like retail space, office space. He's sort of been really dogged, and he stood up to his investors and had to take them on the journey of, we want to create the community. You know, we want to make sure that our buildings are of a certain environmental standard and that we can trace the source of everything. These are principles that are important to us, and you'll see the fruit of creating that kind of community. And I've encouraged him and supported him, but he, not that he needed it from me, he's gone and created, one of the most amazing workplaces and communities. And I hope that he becomes a bit of a case study for what he's been able to do to inspire other communities, physical communities around the world. So I think he's one. I also love the founders of Stripe, which is a payments platform. I thought their market strategy was really good. They went after new entrepreneurs and new businesses. They said they didn't try and convert people that already had payments platforms. They went after the new. And so people are bringing new businesses, new websites on board, and they've grown to be a unicorn themselves. A couple of Irish brothers that flew over, to the States for a summer season and ended up creating a unicorn just with that strategy. And I was really inspired by that approach, because often people look and say, how do we change what exists? They didn't focus on what already existed. They focused just on new customers, which I thought was really awesome.
And they created a business which already had a lot of big established, and to a degree, big new players in there. I mean, PayPal wasn't an old, or isn't a relatively old company, but they still went after a space where there were some big dogs playing in that space.
Yeah, exactly. Another brand in Australia that I love is Koala Mattresses. Danny is a founder from Fishburners, and he's created an incredible business. They were doing $15 million in revenue in their first year, just shaking up a really old industry. With great customer service. I think that's awesome. I love Russ and Kogan. I think, what he's been able to do is really inspiring as well in that space. So there's heaps of Aussie startups that I love, and some of the big industries in terms of the big bricks and mortar companies like International Towers, which isn't a sexy brand, but I've been very interested in the way that they've been able to create a new standard, which is going to change the way that, we all live.
What's next for you? Obviously 2018 is almost finished. Where are you? What are your plans for 2019?
Well, I'm enjoying thoroughly being a dad to two beautiful twin girls who are two, they keep me busy, and I've got my wife, obviously. So we've got a bit of travel next year, and I'm making a huge amount of progress with my clients and helping them do amazing things. Our relationships with our clients are many years. The work that we do takes a long time to get done. I'm sort of working with about a dozen clients, in a big way to make significant shifts in their business, and thoroughly enjoying that. I have some startups that I've invested into, and I probably will start, will be involved in starting one or two new businesses next year as well, which I can't tell you about today, but look forward to maybe if we catch up again in a year, telling you about them.
That was that. I guess that was always fairly predictable that one of a twin would then have twins as children.
Yeah. So
I bet your wife, as soon as she found out you were a twin, was going, no.
I really enjoyed watching, you know, reflecting on my life as a twin and watching my girls have such a close relationship. I think it's really, really awesome. And the community of like twin dads out there, there's, you know, I'm on a Facebook group with 2,500 twin dads from around the world, or multiple dads, really strong, supporting each other. I really love those kind of communities, and places like Facebook and, you know, Facebook groups has really enabled these micro communities to get together no matter where they are and support each other. And I encourage everyone to participate in those communities or go to meetups from meetup.com or something like that and find your tribe, find people that are similar to you, and don't sort of stick with who you know from work or who you met at school. There's plenty of amazing people out there.
So if people want to get hold of you, if they want to get in contact, they've got a question they want to ask you, they've got an idea, or they're in a startup and they're looking for support, where is the best place to come and find you?
Yeah, so the best place is LinkedIn. Check it regularly. Just send me a message and, you know, add me on LinkedIn. Peter, my surname's got two Ds, B-R-A-D-D.
Cool. Wonderful. Well, look, thank you very much for joining me on the show. I know we've had a few technical issues, which is ironic, seeing as you're one of the most influential people in tech in Australia. But of course, that was going to happen today. So thank you very much for joining me.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you very much for joining us today. It has been fantastic. Love the chat with Peter today. You wouldn't believe the amount of technical issues that we had with today's show, which is really ironic, seeing as he's one of the most influential people in Australian tech. Of course, that would happen with me. But there you go. As I say, rate and review us. Otherwise, we will see you next week. Thank you very much for tuning in.